Welcome to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on your cable dial, and you know we're heard around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca. Well, happy 4th to our American friends south, and happy new Government of Canada Day to all who support the Stephen Harper Quislings. We are all, on this 4th of July, experiencing the greatest anthropogenic environmental disaster in history, but incredibly few know it. While most with access to media remember, if vaguely, the April 6th earthquake and subsequent tsunami that knocked out Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear facility, how many are aware of the multiple meltdowns that are ongoing? How many are cognizant of the fact a great swath of Japan is now uninhabitable and will likely remain that way for generations? And how many know right now in the United States, multiple nuclear facilities are on the brink of following Fukushima with the possibility of rendering millions of Americans homeless and making great swaths of that nation a radioactive wasteland? Patrick Henningsen is a UK-based pundit, commentator, online editor, journalist, and founder of 21st Century Wire, a new service launched during the 29 Copenhagen Climate Change Summit. According to them, the 21st Century Wire is an attempt to, quote, deliver content that looks squarely at power, its architecture, as well as the seeds of corruption. Henningsen is in the United States today following the burgeoning story of twin disasters in the making in the heartland that aren't making the headlines. Patrick Henningsen in the first half. And the annual Pastors for Peace caravan to Cuba embarked on its 22nd transcontinental pilgrimage to bring goods sanctioned by the United States to that embargoed Caribbean island. Our own two-time caravanista, CFUV broadcaster and Victoria Street News publisher Janine Bancroft accompanied the Canadian contingent from our neck of the woods here in the Pacific Northwest to the Peace Arch at Blaine, Washington to see this year's cruise safely across the border. Janine Bancroft reporting from the crossing with the Pastors for Peace caravan in the second half. And Janine will join us live at the bottom of the hour to bring us other news from Victoria and beyond. But first, Patrick Henningsen from the waters rising around America's Midwest nuclear facilities. Stick around. Well, welcome to the program, Patrick.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be here, Chris.
Well, it's my pleasure, of course. Now, Pat, where are you right now, and what's the situation there?
Right now, I'm literally on the bank of the Missouri River, just looking out the window now. I'm right now today in Kansas City, which is about a couple hours south of Omaha, Nebraska, where Fort Calhoun nuclear facility is located.
Now, can you tell us, Patrick, most of us up here don't know what Fort Calhoun is. Can you describe briefly what it is and what its function is?
Okay. Yeah, there's a number of older nuclear facilities throughout the United States. In Nebraska, in the Omaha area, you've got two that are located more or less right on the banks of the Missouri River. One of them is Fort Calhoun Nuclear Facility. The other one is Cooper Nuclear Facility. Now, at the moment, and as some of your listeners or readers might be already aware of, the Fort Calhoun facility is more or less underwater. The levees that were protecting that facility, levees 1 and 2, were eclipsed by the river level, and there was a rubber, what you call a berm or a rubber dam, that was the last flood defense around the Fort Calhoun facility. And this is just a side story. Some mysteriously, it was ruptured, punctured last week from an unidentified piece of machinery. So, for intents and purposes, that's a nuclear facility that's been besieged by the waters, the rising waters of the Missouri River. Now, we're all told by the official line, everything's okay. The plant was shut down for maintenance and to put in some new equipment back in April. However, as we're all aware of, since the Fukushima disaster in Japan, which essentially were in theory in the same situation with this Nebraska plant, Fort Calhoun houses 20 years of spent fuel rods on site. And without getting to the details of the ugly ins and outs of the nuclear fuel business, these spent fuel rods are basically recycled to create more nuclear fuel, which is called MOX fuel, and also they extract plutonium from these spent fuel rods, which is used in weapons, nuclear weapons, and also the plutonium and the spent uranium is mixed in with other fuels to create these new lovely little economical nuclear mini fuels that are then redistributed and used again. So it's for all your, if you have environmentally conscious listeners, and I'm sure you've got quite a few, nuclear power has always been touted as a green alternative that's somehow better than fossil fuels and it's safe and there's a lot of protection in place and so forth. And from my research, and if you go to 21stCenturyWired.com, we have a nuclear section, and I've had some of the best people on this subject writing for me, and you can read for yourself that it's anything but safe. And as we saw from Japan, the thing is, there is a risk assessment involved in any business or in any energy delivery system, but the thing is with nuclear, if it goes wrong, the game is over. It's a flat equation. There is no recovery once there is a nuclear incident or there's a core meltdown or you have exposed fuel rods and hydrogen explosions and so forth. The radioactive incidents are non-repairable. They take hundreds of years to have a habitable situation after that. So it's not something that you can do casually, and it's not something that politicians or public agencies or regulatory agencies can make excuses for after the fact. Once it happens, it's happened, and then the damage is widespread.
Well, yeah, Patrick, I published an article that you wrote for 21st Century at my website, pacificfreepress.com, titled Media Blackout, Was There a Nuclear Incident at Fort Calhoun, Nebraska? That has quickly become the most read article on my site, and it's drawn a couple of comments, and one of them alludes, as you mentioned, they say, well, look, why can you be so critical of the nuclear industry? What about oil? There's all these oil spills everywhere, and there's only been one big problem since the Chernobyl disaster in Russia 20-some-odd years ago. But I guess, like the terrorists, a nuclear disaster, they only need to do it once, and this doesn't seem to be resonating with people. There was a third, Patrick, there was a third nuclear, an ongoing nuclear disaster or potential disaster happening in the United States at Los Alamos, the birthplace of this industry. I understand that the fires now, the wildfires that were threatening the Los Alamos laboratories have been gotten under control, and yet I don't read anything about the spent fuel rods, as you described, that all of their waste that is off-site and that had and that was above ground, protected only by tents, canvas tents, that had been approached by the fire, but I haven't heard anything more. Do you know more about the status of Los Alamos, Patrick?
I don't, and you know, you won't hear anything about Los Alamos because that is one of the most protected and most confidential classified facilities. Because it is at the hub of the United States military-industrial complex. So you will not hear, if anything does happen at Los Alamos, you won't hear. I mean, there have been independent Geiger counter readings done by people, and you can find them on the Internet around Fort Calhoun. And according to that information, and enough people have access to this equipment now, and there's a lot of good independent activists and journalists out there who will go down with the Geiger counter and take a reading. And there seems to be no radioactive rise in radioactive levels around Fort Calhoun at the moment. Now, that, and I've spoke to people, within the governing system there, and I've done that under confidentiality, but I've been told that it's okay at the moment and that everything's under control. Now, the only problem is it's under control now, but will it be under control in a week or will it be under control in a month? Missouri River is expected to raise another 5 to 6 feet by anyone's guesstimate over the next 5 or 6 weeks. So you still have a rise in the level there, and so the risk is still imminent. Now, the other thing is if you go to this media blackout article that we did at 21st Century Wire, you'll see that there are not just Chernobyl, not just Three Mile Island. There are half a dozen major incidences in the United States alone, plus in France and other places around the world. Now, there was one in particular in Los Angeles that happened. It was a full-core meltdown 20 miles outside of central Los Angeles. That was in the late 50s, in the early 60s, and that was not made really public until some 40 years later. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when it comes to, you know, the stakes are high in the nuclear game, and the amount of money spent in lobbying Congress and the Senate and for legislation and for regulation of this industry, it's a big business. And unfortunately, like any business, it's a corrupt business when you get down to the federal lobbying level and the amount of money that changes hands for contracts, municipal power delivery contracts, and so forth. It's a big business. So a little thing like safety is, of course, it's a concern for people in the industry and for engineers and so forth. But on the business side of that industry, shortcuts have been used in the past to save money or to expedite a project and so forth. And the public is then put at risk in that situation. And that's kind of what we're approaching here at Fort Calhoun in Nebraska. Everything's fine now, but when the penny drops, all of a sudden everything's a disaster. And you have a number of agencies blaming each other. You have the Nuclear Regulatory Commission saying that it's the Omaha Power, Public Power District or Department's responsibility to protect the plant. The Army Corps of Engineers are in charge of the Missouri River and the dam system that goes right up to the Rocky Mountains. They're not responsible for the safety or the protection of that nuclear plant. And so you could easily have a shot like you had in Katrina. The big hurricane in Katrina, where the people who built the levees weren't responsible for the maintenance of the levees. So you have this guy blaming that guy, and the next thing you know, the levees burst, and you have a major disaster in your hands. And it's too late after that for people to be blaming each other. People need to get together. And if public safety is not number one on the priority list of every single person in any of these federal agencies or bodies, then they really need to reassess what they're doing in that profession and you know, are they earning their paycheck?
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, and CFUV.uvic.ca on the internet everywhere else. I'm speaking tonight with Patrick Henningsen, and Patrick is a UK-based pundit, commentator, online editor, journalist, and founder of 21st Century Wire. You can find that, as Patrick said, at 21stcenturywire.com. That's the number 21. It's a new service he launched with others in 2009 following the Copenhagen Climate Change Summit. Well, you mentioned Katrina, Patrick. And the levees there, well, some of them collapsed and some of them were destroyed. Deborah Dupre, writing today online, says that somebody that at the time of writing, person still unknown, had blown up one of the levees upstream of both Fort Calhoun and Cooper. Are you following that?
Yeah, I mean, they're also controlled operations, because obviously they've got a whole system of levees and dams that stretches for hundreds of miles right up the Missouri River, Yellowstone River. In fact, an Exxon mm-hmm. pipeline just burst a few days ago on the Yellowstone River, so you have 20,000 liters of oil just on the Yellowstone River, which feeds directly into the Missouri River. So you've got that on top of this current situation. You've got that upstream. But this whole system of dams, there's controlled releases, there's strategic decisions made to release pressure. Obviously, it's better to have easy pressure come out in some areas than have a major full global collapse of a protection or a levee system. But certainly in Katrina, I did hear reports about levees being blown. And, you know, obviously that's difficult to... to track and document. But
well, in Deborah Dupree's case,
Dupree, someone
did blow up one of the levees along the Missouri. It wasn't the government; it was on private property. There's some of these landowners have built their own berms and levees over the years, and apparently they're not happy with the way the government's handling the flood emergency there. And so some of these people are taking it into their own hands and maybe, you know, considering more saving theirs and their neighbors' farmland than the effects that this might have downstream on something like the nuclear plant and what effect that's going to have on their farmland.
Well, the big effect on the big level of the Missouri is upstream. A lot of they've had record snowfalls this year, and have, in fact, record snowfalls the last couple of years up on the high altitude levels. And Montana and Billings, they had a year's worth of rainfall within the month of May. So that's added a little bit stress to the system. And also, you also have to take into account this is a very delicate balancing act, because actually, you know, we're playing God with one of the most powerful waterways on this side of the Western Hemisphere, the Missouri River, very difficult to tame. And obviously, forget about global warming or climate change. We've had record snowfalls up in the Rockies and record colds in the winter, a huge amount of rain this year. So it's really caught them unawares. Fort Calhoun, the 40-year-old facility, it was supposed to be decommissioned some 15 or 20 years ago, and they extended the license right up to 2030. So, but you know, the other thing is, why are these plants built on the banks of the Missouri River? And number two, why would such old facilities still be kept running if they're only providing between 10 and 20% of the base load for the regional power grid? And one of the reasons they're also being kept open is because it's a business.
Yeah.
A lot of them are bomb factories. Mm-hmm. And the United States just okayed $180 billion on top of their annual $50 billion budget to upgrade and modernize their arsenal. So, you know, a lot of these things are connected. The military-industrial complex is very connected with the nuclear power industry. You cannot talk about both of them exclusively. They are very much connected. So people within the industry would like to mislead you a little bit, tell you that that's not the case, but it all does come together. Nuclear is an unbelievably dirty business. We documented that on 21st Century Wire and put everything together in one place so that you can go and check the references and check the links, and you can really learn about the inside of this business, which is written by an insider who works for us.
Well, this confluence of environmental disasters, the Exxon spill, the high water, the high snowfall, the aging infrastructure, it sounds like it's all starting to end. Of course, the weaponization of nuclear and the increasing militarism in the United States, it sounds like it's all making up for a parable of our times. One of the concerns voiced, again, in Dupree's article was on the Gavin Point Dam. Now, she describes this in Yankton, South Dakota. It's one of the largest ones. It's built by the same people who brought you the levees in New Orleans that didn't do so well, the Army Corps of Engineers. And now it's maxing out. They're worried about this is going to go down, and this threatens the Cooper nuclear facility. You said you didn't get any elevated readings from volunteers near Fort Calhoun. Have any of those volunteers managed to get close enough to the Cooper facility, and do we know where their waste is stored and if that is safe from the rising waters?
Well, my understanding is that all the spent fuel rods from the state of Nebraska will go to Fort Calhoun, so that's where all that fuel is stored. So, but having said that, there are already drawing up some evacuation plans to some towns around the Cooper, near the Cooper facility. So they are preparing for the worst. That reactor has not been shut down. That reactor is still going full speed, and that's a little bit of a concern. I think would be a little bit of a public safety concern. I think if there was a heavy rainfall in the next few weeks, plus the water releases that they have to do upstream in the Dakotas and in Montana with the dam system, you could have the Cooper facility under threat. So that is a little bit worrying. But Mother Nature has thrown a massive curveball into the equation in the last couple months, and they're clearly not prepared to deal with it. If they were prepared to deal with it, we wouldn't be seeing what we're seeing right now.
Well, of course, Mother Nature can be blamed for disasters that befall man, but what about the media in this case and the disaster that they are? Your article begins on saying, well, is this a media blackout? What about the way communications are being handled and the way people are or aren't being given the right information that may be vital to save their lives in this case? How about the media performance on this, Patrick?
Well, if you want any indication of where the priorities are for the OPPD, which is the Omaha Public Power Department, they've set up a flood rumor control page on their website to reassure the public that there has been no release of radioactivity from the plant. So, just the Orwellian name used, their flood rumor control page, pretty much speaks volumes. Mm-hmm. This could be a no-go area for some of the major local affiliate networks. It could be a no-go area. I mean, Steve Everly from the Kansas City Star wrote a very good article a few days ago, which is on the Kansas City Star's website. But he's pretty much pushed the envelope as far as he could push it with the contacts he had within the OPPD and the NRC. They're going to be very tight-lipped about anything any dangers or any concerns they have, or if there's an incident, you won't hear about it for a while. You'll hear about it on the internet in the independent media or on a forum before you're going to hear about it from a major network or from a major newspaper, and that's pretty much you can pretty much go to the bank with that one. You're not going to see it on the major networks first. They'll pick up the story after there's so much, if something happens, if there's so much pressure from the alternative media and from community activists, then they will then go with the story. But it'll be a case of damage control if it happens. Let's hope that it doesn't happen. But there's a huge risk there. It's an identical scenario with Fukushima. The only difference is it's not a tsunami. This is a flooding Missouri River. So we'll see what happens.
Well, and this ancient infrastructure that, you know, to cut corners and budgets to better make bombs and bullets and fight wars in faraway places, is all starting to show its age. And this really could be, I'd hate to use the term, but the perfect storm in that case. Patrick, we're fast out of time right now, but could you please reiterate your website and where people might follow up on your reports coming out of Nebraska?
Sure. You can go to 21stcenturywire.com. That's 21st centurywire.com. There'll be some reports in the next few days. I'm going to fly back to London on Wednesday evening, so we'll hopefully have something up beforehand. But it's still a little bit of a guessing game at the moment. So I'm just basically putting together enough useful information so that people can go and they can decide for themselves what they think is happening with this situation, and then they can choose to take action. That's what our website's about. It's about informing people, giving people the tools so that they can take action or make a decision themselves and take it a little bit further. So we're hoping nothing serious happens with this, but if it does, people need to be prepared ahead of time.
Well, and I'm sure George Monbiot would tell you everything's going to be okay. Nuclear can't hurt you. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Patrick Henningsen, for coming on again. 21stcentury.com. Check it out. And we'll hopefully follow up with you on this, Patrick.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for bringing me to the show.
Okay, you bet. Good night now. All right, now I'm going to take a brief break, but when I come back, I'm going to be joined by Janine, and she's had a very busy weekend, and you'll just wait for this.
Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Now you're hungry. Breathe in. breathe out. The brain automates a lot of tasks, so we don't even have to think about them. But what if it didn't? Protect your head. Brain injury can make all the things you don't think about very difficult. Brain injury can occur almost anywhere. Be smart. Wear your seatbelt. Shred with a helmet. And be alert. Find out more at protectyourhead.com.
This message from the BC Association of Broadcasters.
Well, joining me now, as oft time she does, is Janine Bancroft. Hey, Janine, how's it going?
Well, I thought that I was actually intended to provide an update on what's going on in Victoria after I worked so hard all day yesterday, Chris.
Well, I just ran into Rose Henry as I was coming in here, and she had big news, but I don't know if you're following
it. What's her big news?
She says that Monday Magazine is approaching her to do a profile, and some other people or film people are interested, and this is, you know, leading up to her her trip to Scotland.
Wow, that's awesome. She's really she's an amazing woman, you know, and I have to hand it to her. She's done a really great job of fundraising, and I think I mentioned we've paid for her airfare and her accommodations, and she's if people want to continue to support Rose, she's trying to buy a laptop or a notebook so that she can be more, you know, more digitally connected while she's out running around doing her good work of keeping an eye on what's going on in the street community. So that's good news.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, I was lollygagging around here listening to the great music that comes from the CFUV station and sort of keeping an eye on the television. And they've got these HST ads. Like, how much money are they putting into this HST campaign, Chris? That they're making it sound like, you know, you're just loopy if you don't like this thing.
Well, you know, and I always think, I mean, God, I always get this guy mixed up. I don't know if it was I.F. Stone or Mencken that said, you know, you never believe anything the government says until they deny it, right? Well, I mean, whenever I hear them promoting something, I know, well, this can't be good for me. And the more they promote it, then the more I'm convinced that this is really bad for me. And using that model, which, by the way, I'm not a young man anymore. It's tried and true, believe me, youngsters. Judging by that, this HST is really bad, really, really bad for me. And every time I see those ads, I think, God, this is bad for me, and I'm going to vote yes to extinguish
right.
it.
Right. Yeah, I know. They pay all this money for these ads that tell you to vote no, and it's all very confusing. Anyways, that we've got till, I think, the 22nd to make up our minds about how we feel about paying all this extra money everywhere we go, you know, for what? For all the great social programs we get, I suppose.
This is a regressive tax. This is what you got to know, and regressive taxes means it's taxation without representation.
Yeah, I think it's paying off the Olympics, basically, is my theory. I mean, we don't have social programs. They've cut funding for pretty much everything, right? So it's not like they're pumping money back into, you know, social programs for all. Yeah.
Well, you're going to get me started here. Don't go getting me started.
I won't get you started. I won't. I want to tell you about a couple of really great things that are going on around town. I met with a young man named Eric last week, and he has created this website called socialcoast.ca. And it seems like it's meant to be sort of a Facebook for activists. So perhaps young people who, you know, they enjoy Facebook because they can socialize with their friends, but maybe they're looking to reach out in a different way maybe create a different social network. And so this is a place to do that. And he's encouraging environmentalists and peace activists, either as individuals or as organizations, to go to socialcoast.ca. And then you set up your little profile, just like you do on Facebook, and then you have a chance to you make your friends, right, and you enter into discussion with various organizations. And so it's an opportunity to kind of check out different groups and different people and see whose values are kind of aligned with your own. And it looks like a really interesting thing. So I would encourage people to go to socialcoast.ca. Of course, probably more in the winter because it is summer and we should be outside. And the Paddle for the Peace is this weekend. I think this is a second or third or fourth Paddle for the Peace, isn't it, Chris?
You've got me there. I know that there was one last year. I can't remember a year before. I mean, it's amazing I can remember even last year or last week for that matter. I mean,
it is amazing, isn't it? You're getting so much older and the memory going and all of that.
Uh-huh.
I know you're so much older than me, too. I enjoy that. And I almost went to the one last year, you know, and I investigated. And this is a long ways north. This is like a 24-hour drive out of Kamloops or something. I mean, it's way far north, and it's this massive, big, beautiful valley, apparently. I haven't ever been up there, but the people who talk about it just say how magnificent it is and what a devastating thing it would be to dam this river. And for what, right? So that they can build more hydroelectric, I guess, power plants, so that they can ship energy to the U.S., so that the U.S. people can continue to live in this great denial, you know, and continue to live in their mansions and golf on their green golf courses and drink their bottled water and have their air conditioning cranked up to the max, I suppose. I mean, that seems to be what this is about. We do generate enough energy in BC to provide our own needs, but unfortunately, because of NAFTA, we are supposed to be providing energy to the great beast south of us there. And so anyways, the Paddle for the Peace is a way to celebrate the beauty of the valley, and it's organized by the Peace Valley Environment Association and the West Moberly First Nations, and it's happening on Saturday, July 9th, and if you start cycling now, you might get there by Saturday. There's a breakfast and entertainment 9 till 11, and then away you go. And this is an effort to, like I say, raise awareness and realize that we really got to find a better way than flooding another valley. So, and speaking of those wacky neighbors of ours, I was very happy to. It's like a little reunion, you know. I'm a two-time caravanista now. I've traveled with the Pastors for Peace Friendshipment Caravan to Cuba 2 years, and so a lot of people go regularly. Like, once people latch onto this thing, it becomes almost an addiction. And so I met Sabine yesterday. She's a German woman who has been going on the caravan since 1998. She's an elder for sure, and you know, and she comes all the way from Germany. And you know, the main reason that she goes, she loves Cuba and the Cubans, and she loves bringing aid. But she could travel directly from Germany. I mean, there's, you know, but she loves the idea of going through the U.S. and meeting all the wonderful people, because she says, you know, just like we don't, when we turn on the news or we hear news of the U.S., we hear all about the wacky, crazy things that are going on. But this is really an opportunity to meet up with all the wonderful peace activists and environmentalists, and there are a lot of them, thankfully, in the U.S. So, yeah, we had a lot of fun with the caravan yesterday. Thank you. I'm sorry I dragged you away from your afternoon with your friend Christina.
Well, okay, and
I appreciate your press release work.
Well, okay. Now that doesn't mean anything to anybody. Now, can you set up that? Can you set the piece up and without, you know, spoiling the content of it?
Sure. Well, I'm sure all of your listener, Christina, and that other person are familiar with what I'm talking about, because they are following your website. And so yeah, this is about bringing humanitarian aid through the United States, 15 different routes of caravans, of buses and trucks and vans, and they collect aid as they go, and they make presentations and about the U.S. blockade on Cuba, which a lot of people don't even know about, and then they cross again into Mexico, July 20th or 21st. They're going to be crossing into Mexico, and every time they try to cross the border, it's an effort, especially the U.S. border. So once they get to Mexico, then all the goods go onto a ship, and it sails over to Cuba, and the caravanistas fly to Cuba and experience the wonders of the socialist revolution. And so, yeah, yesterday I went over with some friends to see the caravanistas off and to make sure that the aid got safely across the border. And I think for the first time ever, they experienced at the Canadian border. Not from the Canadians. The Canadians don't have any trouble with this at all, it seems. But the U.S., they're just getting more and more uptight or something, you know. On the 20th and 21st, when they try to go into Mexico, you know, they have to go and show the Mexicans what all the aid is and assure them that there's no bombs or anything, you know, silly like that. And that's fair enough. But they actually have to go through Homeland Security and explain to the U.S. why they're taking stuff out of the country, which I just find as absurd as the Greeks not allowing the ships to leave Greece, but that's a whole other story. And I don't want to take too much time because I have prepared a sort of 25-minute synopsis of the events of yesterday, which we thought was just going to go as normal and we'd all be home for dinner sort of thing. And we ended up by, I think it was 8 o'clock when we finally got this stuff across the border.
Okay, well, as you say, it's 25 minutes. And for some reason, I thought it was 21. Okay, well, then, Janine, what we'll do then, we'll just go straight to it, and I'll forego a music break this time and go straight to your reporting from the scene as the Cuba caravan, the 22nd annual, makes an attempt to cross the border from White Rock, British Columbia, into Blaine. Thanks a lot, Janine.
Okay, and I'll just say that I did sort of focus on what the caravanistas were saying rather than the battle that we had with the border. If people want the full account of the whole hour of audio that I recorded, it's at janinebancroft.wordpress.com.
Okay, Janine, and of course your show every other Thursday, Winds of Change, right here at CFUV and the Street News newspaper. Okay, Janine, thanks a lot. Until the next time.
Thank you so much, Chris.
All right, then. Bye-bye. All right, then. Here is the aforementioned audio.
Beginning of July, and we're going to send the 22nd caravan to Cuba on its way. Looks like some of the people from the U.S. have yet to arrive. I believe everyone here is from the Canadian contingent. I see Sabine, who has been on many caravans. I met her when I was on the caravan a couple of years ago. She travels from Germany to go on this caravan to challenge the U.S. blockade and bring humanitarian aid to Cuba. Lots of devoted people who work on this campaign throughout the year collecting humanitarian aid in the form of school buses and school supplies and hospital supplies. And then we're gathering here, and I would imagine at two or three other points across Canada to send this caravan on its way. And then it will commence traveling through the United States for the next couple of weeks, and then they'll converge in McAllen, Texas, where all of the aid will be sorted and listed and cataloged so they know exactly what's going to Cuba. And this is a people-to-people caravan, much like the efforts by the Freedom Flotilla to Gaza. It's not about governments. This is about people caring about people and risking all sorts of their lives, basically, to bring humanitarian aid to people who need it. So we're going to spend the next little while here and bring some information about some of these people and why they're doing what they're doing.
We're so happy all of you are here to join us today. We have representatives from across British Columbia and Washington State, and it's just great to all be here together in the Peace Arch Park, sending off this caravan of love and friendship to the people of Cuba, and to be here to demand an end to the criminal and inhuman U.S. blockade against Cuba. Again, my name is Tamara Hansen. I'm the coordinator of Vancouver Communities in Solidarity with Cuba. The first person in our program today is Kelly White. She is a Salish elder, and she is an advocate for the missing Aboriginal women across Canada.
In the highest of the honor, it's thank the spirit of all good that we can be blessed to be the chosen ones that are here today for Sister Cuba. And in the spirit of the honor of our Salish people, I'd like to share our Salish peace anthem. Our peace and prayer song comes from Musqueam Longhouse. And interpret for it as we come in peace. And I'd like to honor the ones that are traveling this year, as well as all those that are here for support.
Cuba and the Cuban Revolution, because they have made tremendous gains, regardless that they have a 50-year cruel unilateral blockade from the United States government. And I want to make the connection, because it was made before, with the Cuban side. You know, when we talk about we are for sovereignty of Cuba, for self-determination of the Cuban people, the Cuban side are representing that country. So when we are in solidarity with Cuba, we are also in solidarity with the Cuban side. And I wanted to tell you that the Cuban side would be very proud to know what we are doing here. They support everybody in solidarity with Cuba. They're very proud that people don't do what the mainstream people in the United States or in Canada do, which is, you know, live the life that they have. They can't work, working, and they don't have the extra, they don't take the extra time as all of you do to be behind a just cause. There are many causes to fight for, but I think this is a beautiful one. And I wanted to tell you that I have been very, very moved by my experience here in Vancouver and meeting wonderful people that I never will forget. And I will take them with me, because I didn't know them when I first came here. And now, you know, we are friends. I have so many more friends now. And I will always remember all of you for your kindness and the great organizing skills that you have had, especially the young people.
Ruth Castle from Nanaimo, BC, and she is here today to read a poem by Antonio Guerrero, one of the Cuban Five held in U.S. prisons.
So I traveled with the caravan last year. I wanted to read this poem because it's such an inspiration to me whenever I read it, just for my own life. And I wanted to share it with the people going down through the states. It's a long, arduous journey through the states, through Mexico. Once you get to Cuba, you're just treated better than royalty. People will just love you there. And so this is from Antonio to all of us. I want to make song of each day, in each heart to discover a brother, to share what I have with each hand without fearing. I want that a rain of harmony penetrate the roots of humanity, that the actions of the vile and profane transform into goodness and congeniality, that in each morning a smile have the magnitude of a mountain, and from the breeze a gesture of peace arises, reaching the place in ourselves most deep, that we blossom, showing only love, united as petals of the same flower.
All right, so can everyone please give a warm welcome to Tom Warner?
We've got a bus with a couple of dozen boxes full of material aid for Cuba, and retired college professor whose daughter's life by a Cuban doctor when she was in Africa went to the Lowe's Hardware and bought $120 worth of hurricane fixing tools, and it's in there. And then we got another call from a guy, and he said, come clean out all the tools in my shed that are might be useful to the Cubans.
Rick Fellows from Olympia.
Thanks all for coming. Really appreciate all the support out of Western Canada. You're all really great. This year we're sort of lamenting the loss of our founding pastor, Reverend Lucius Walker. He's moved so many people over so many years to take such sacrifice for ethical principles that he stood behind. And when people saw how he stood behind his principles, they were willing to get behind him in hunger fasts that lasted long amounts of time and facing down all kinds of paramilitary groups in Chiapas and all kinds of things like that. So we're lamenting his loss this year, but also celebrating, you know, the incredible achievements and trying to keep this one alive. He was committed to keeping these caravans alive until the embargo was ended. And I hope we can all try to keep supporting this and keep the challenge going to bring about a normalization of relations with Cuba. Cuba is a very significant issue to me, largely because I've also visited other countries in Latin America. I've spent a lot of time learning about Guatemala, El Salvador, these countries, and how their flat lands and plantations and factories are owned by U.S.-based corporations. And when you see the amount of repression that's happened in those countries, the helicopters that have flown over villages with machine guns blazing, and the millions of people who've been displaced in Guatemala, a million people internally and a million people driven out of Guatemala during a scorched earth period in the early 1980s. It's where I met Rolando, the photographer, years ago. He was a photographer in the mid-80s, documented the incomes of people that were flowing over the borders into from Guatemala into Chiapas, Mexico. But these other countries show what Cuba's about, why there's such a desperation on the part of the powers of the United States to not let Cuba stand. It's because they nationalized the holdings of Standard Oil, and they nationalized the holdings of United Fruit Company, and they did, at that time, an incredibly significant land reform. In Colombia, 2% of the population owns 73% of the land or something, and you go country by country, it's like that. In Honduras, 60% of their export earnings go to United States corporations. So Cuba is really critical to the rest of Latin America. It's not just about the great things Cuba's done. It's also in the context of the rest of Latin America. It sits there as an example that nobody can deny of the difference. You go across the water to Haiti, and there's no reason why Cuba would be any different. If they hadn't had a revolution, they'd be deforested, they'd have plantations, they'd have an apartheid system of politics, economics, and society. So Cuba stands very important in all of those things. Cuba also nowadays understands the importance of environment. There's an awful lot of stuff going on with energy and agriculture that's also setting a model right now that people can look to and see. And I really think that this is where we need to go, is be multi-issue. I think as long as we're really divided down into issues, we're going to have a lot of trouble changing the kind of power structures that we're really ultimately about trying to change. By becoming more multi-issue, we can be forming alliances with people that work across human rights, environment, social justice, prison justice, all kinds of issues. And the more we do that, the stronger we're likely to become. The media is controlled by large corporations, just so we won't get the kind of ideas into our heads that might be able to help us change all of this. So we also need to be all on a campaign to try to increase the consciousness of the people about the conflicts of interest of letting corporations control media. It's really gone too far, and it's been getting worse and worse. It was already bad 30 years ago. When they saw the social movements of the 70s in the United States, they decided to really figure out how to keep that from happening again. And they've just gotten really good at clamping down on diversity of public opinion and controlling the limits of legitimate debate in the United States, and I'm sure somewhat in Canada too. So critical to all of this, folks, I think, is going to be to try to get people to challenge their media diets and look for alternative sources of information and spread the word that corporations have an incredible conflict of interest in controlling mass media. I think that's all I want to say right now. And thanks all for coming.
I would like to invite up again all of the caravanistas who are going this year. We have Will Itchison, Sabina Kaspar, Aaron Mercury, Janine Palenke, Sarah Alwell, Faye Van Pageback, Rick Fellows, and Alicia
I guess I just wanted to use this opportunity to learn more about Cuba. I haven't really been involved with the Cuba Solidarity work in the past, but this seemed like a good place to start. So I want to go down and learn more about the exciting stuff that's going on there.
Hi, everyone. My name is Janine Solanke. I'm from Vancouver, and very excited to be going on my second caravan. And I think what motivated me to go is I had been to Cuba a few times and had the great opportunity to learn a lot from the Cuban people and everything that they've achieved there. But we can learn a lot and we can take a lot from Cuba, but we also need to defend Cuba, and that's what this caravan is all about, breaking the blockade on Cuba and letting the rest of the world and U.S. citizens be able to see Cuba for themselves. Thank you.
My name is Sarah Allwell, and I'm leaving from Victoria, British Columbia. I'm really excited to be going on the caravan this year. I'm an apprentice carpenter, and I got laid off from work last Wednesday. And it was the first time I was really happy to lose my job. And I was like, hell yeah, I'm going to Cuba! I went to the caravan last year as well, and I think something that Reverend Lucius Walker used to say, which is very true, is that we don't do these caravans really because Cuba needs us, but because we need Cuba. And because we need the example that Cuba shows that, and what it's able to do in for the world and in the struggle for the better world that we're trying to build, despite having 50 years of a blockade. And we do this to break the blockade also because imagine what the people of Cuba could do when that blockade is lifted. How many more doctors they could send around the world to help and provide free medical care to people all around the world, how many more struggles they could support. So we do this because we need Cuba, and I'm so happy to see everybody out here today in support of the caravan and in support of Cuba, because we're really, if you look around, as we travel down through the United States and we get to that border, no matter what happens, we're going to get that aid across. But if the U.S. border guards decide to give us a problem, we're going to depend on all of you that are here today to help us to get the word out and to make sure that aid gets to Cuba. So take a look around at everybody who's here today, because those are the people that you're going to rely on, and that we're going to rely on all of you to get that aid across. So give yourselves a big round of applause. Thank you for being here.
International, and that's when I first came over, and I've become a caravan. And I come again because I think that the main struggle has to be fought in the U.S., because the U.S. is the country that is strangling Cuba and is preventing its self-determination. And I also come because I like to meet the good people in the United States, the people who work for peace and justice to make the world a better place.
Hey everyone, my name is Aaron Mercury. I'm from Vancouver, and like Sarah, I'm also recently unemployed and extremely excited. For us, this is a great opportunity. It's a great opportunity to meet people, and more importantly, we're part of a worldwide movement to end this blockade. It's not just Canada and it's not just the U.S., although this is where the route's going. But this is a campaign that has support all around the world. And knowing that this group of people here is a part of that is strengthening for us, because we all know you. But we know through the work of others that this is connected beyond so many borders. Thanks.
We proceeded with caravanistas and a van full of humanitarian aid destined for Cuba to the U.S.-Canada border at the Peace Arch Park there, where the caravanistas were allowed entry. It took considerable time for them to cross the border. They were allowed entry. However, the van was refused. We were told it was commercial goods, and we were to go to the truck crossing a little farther east. So that's what we did, and we set up banners upon hearing at the truck crossing that now there was a bond required, and this is an unusual tactic, a bit of game playing, I suspect, from the U.S. authorities. They were attempting to collect money from the Pastors for Peace in exchange for allowing humanitarian aid to travel through their country. A lawyer was notified by Pastors for Peace, and the lawyer contacted the U.S. border authorities. She told them that this is nonsense, and provided the law that states that we are entitled to bring humanitarian aid through the United States. And the van was x-rayed. The U.S. border authorities eventually relinquished their stranglehold. By this time it was about 8 o'clock at night, and so we had a bit of a celebration. So what follows is a conversation with Andrew Berry, who is driving the van at both borders. This is a conversation, first attempt to cross at the Peace Arch. And then what follows that is the celebration, as we realize that the van is going to be able to proceed to across the border, and the aid was loaded onto the bus along with the caravanistas, and they're heading through the United States. I would invite you to stay tuned to CFUV, to the Winds of Change.
And I'll invite you to check in with Janine's website. That's janinebancroft.wordpress.com if you want to hear the entirety of that. I don't have time for it tonight, but I want to thank Patrick Henningsen and remind you to go to his website, 21st Century Wire, that's 21stwire.com, to learn more about the nuclear situation. He's down there in Nebraska right now on that story. Thanks again to Janine, as always, and all the good folks up here at the station that help bring things to fruition every week. And I want to remind you, especially jazz lovers, well, if you're coming down from a high from this week's fantastic Jazz Fest, well, despair not, because coming straight up is Arnold with the Rhythmining to keep the jazz going on this beautiful 4th of July here in Victoria. Until the next time.